Hello and welcome to another episode of The Grey NATO, a loose discussion of travel, adventure, diving, driving, gear, and most certainly watches. This is episode 240, and it's proudly brought to you by you, the ever-growing TGN supporter crew. We thank you all so much for your continued support. And if you're listening and interested in supporting the show and you don't already, please visit thegreynato.com for more details. James, how's it going? Speaking of driving and diving, we did a little of each. I think you had a bit of a weekend away as well, right?
I did, yeah. I took the opportunity. The weather was kind of mixed bag around here, but we went up to the cottage for kind of the first weekend. It was the May long weekend for us, so you know, by the time this comes out, you'll be on the eve of the American long weekend. Ours was the Monday before, so yeah, we went up and kicked around at the cottage a little bit, got in the water. It was nice and very cold but it rained pretty good on Saturday, but it was a nice evening. We got to see some family and hang out with a couple of my siblings and that sort of thing, so it's always nice to kind of kick off the season that way and get an idea for what we want to, you know, kind of complete this year on the project and that kind of stuff. So yeah, there's some balls in the air and some plans and that sort of thing. But it was a good weekend for sure. It just went by way too quickly. Even with a sort of half holiday on Monday, obviously my main employment's with an American company. So
yeah.
Not always, you're not offline on a holiday Monday in Canada.
Right. And how are the mosquitoes? They're absolutely horrible here.
Pretty bad, man. Pretty bad. You know, really bad. A green spring is looking like it's going to be tough. I'm going to be probably going into the TGN Slack and asking people who have tried some of like the more military grade sort of solutions. You know, there's these ones that cost, you know, several hundred dollars and can do a certain square footage.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
That might be an option. I don't really know at this point. Like, we've used the Thermacell. I think I've talked about it on past episodes, but it was really bad. Yeah, we came back with you know, 20 bites a piece. And that wasn't, you know, it was also one of those scenarios. It's that May thing where it had just rained and it had been kind of a wet spring. So it was all day long.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like they only came out at dusk.
Yeah, I found that too.
They were just around.
Yeah. Yeah. Right in the middle of the day, we were out gardening over the weekend. It was, you know, pushing upper 70s. You know, usually in the middle of the day, they kind of give you a break. But man, they're just swarming here. I think, we really got spoiled last year. It was such a dry summer and there were hardly any bugs, but now it's payback time, I guess.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see. Hopefully it's not indicative of the entire season, but, you know, man, I really hope in a decade we don't find out that like bug spray is legitimately terrible for you or something like that, because it's kind of the only solution aside from going inside.
Yeah.
Which we did the one night. We had a nice fire going and then people were just kind of like, I'm getting bit through my jeans. I'm getting bit through the whole thing. So let's get inside. So
yeah,
that is what it is. But how was the diving? You drove out to Milwaukee. How long? I mean, maybe an obvious question for somebody from your area, but how long of a drive is that?
So the Defender is still in the shop for those electrical issues. So I did not take that, which made the trip a little quicker because I took our Volvo and was able to maintain normal interstate speeds and got there in 5.5 hours with a couple of kind of leg stretcher breaks along the way.
So bad.
So it's really not. It's a fairly boring drive, but it's quick. I've done it, you know, many years and very familiar. Just set the cruise control. I listened to a book, and before I knew it, I was there. So it was good. I stayed with my buddy Chris. He's still living in the town that we grew up in and went to high school in. It's always fun to get back there. And then let's see, I got there on Tuesday, you know, right after we recorded, and then we got up early on Wednesday and went diving. We got a friend down there who has a small but nice boat, which serves as kind of a nice little platform for diving. And he took us out from the marina in the morning, and we had to, well, I shouldn't say the morning, because we had to wait for the wind to die down. The waves were kind of choppy and wasn't really pleasant or safe to get out there in a small boat. And so we waited until a little after noon and then headed out, and it was, you know, borderline kind of rough conditions, but we got in the water and did the dive. And unfortunately the buoy that was placed on the wreck this early in the season wasn't at the right end of the wreck for what we wanted to do, but we still had a nice time. And well, I should say I had a nice time. Chris's dry suit leaked fairly badly and he's still not sure where, because it's a new suit.
Oh goodness.
So he got kind of borderline hypothermia. I mean, by the end of the dive, he was in some trouble there. So we got out and headed back, and by that time the weather had calmed down. But you know, it's always an adventure. I mean, Great Lakes diving is just, it's not it's never predictable, and it's but the upside is you don't really see anybody else out there, so it was good. in many respects, and just good to get down there and hang out with a friend. It was fun.
I'm definitely looking forward to, like I've said on past episodes recently, just getting into the lake with some of the gear this summer. So
yeah,
certainly shouldn't be as gnarly as kind of some of that stuff. And definitely my guess is right now, if I attempted to use my dry suit, I would also end up very wet. So we'll see. It's sat for some time. We'll have to see how that held up and if it needs new seals and all that kind of stuff. But
yeah, I'm guessing the lake would be a wetsuit or even in the midsummer, probably just a swimsuit, right?
I think unless you were really sitting still.
Yeah.
For a good period of time, the water gets pretty warm. It's a shallow lake, all things considered.
Yeah.
I think the average depth of the bay is about 15 feet.
Oh, okay.
Maybe 18 feet, something like that. So, yeah, I mean, I'm not going to go down and just sit still. Like, I'm not going down and doing, you know, underwater photography of pike or something like that. I'm not just going to sit still and hope they come along.
Yeah.
So, finning around and stuff, I don't intend to wear any sort of coverage. Just throw the BC on.
Yeah, that's the dream.
7 mil here if I needed it, but I think in water that shallow I'd probably rather have less to compensate for.
Mm-hmm.
While I kind of get my buoyancy back.
That's the dream. I love that idea of kind of diving in a small inland lake where you can sort of just wade off the beach with your gear. That's so should be cool.
Definitely looking forward to it. Be back up there in a couple weeks. Working my way through an internet install up there as well. So theoretically, we'll have our first truly remote studio for TGN. At the cabin. I'm not sure that this internet will be able to do that, but we'll give it a try. Maybe if you miss an episode sometime in the future, that's going to be why.
Right.
That sort of thing. But yeah, this should be a fun one today. And we're actually, speaking of episode timing, we're going to be holding this episode. So if you're listening to it and you're wondering why it came out Friday morning instead of Thursday morning, it's going to come out May 26th. We're actually just holding it for the launch of a watch, this new model from Aquastar. So we'll talk about that watch in the next few minutes, but that's the reason that we delayed it. The embargo for that watch was Friday morning at 9 a.m. EDT. So we wanted to chit-chat about it. It's a kind of a very TGN thing from a guy we've had on the show and the rest of it. We're big Aquastar fans, so that's pretty straightforward. So stay tuned for that. But before we get that far, you want to jump into a little bit of wrist check?
Sure. I think we've got a theme going here today.
We do, yeah.
What do you have on?
I went down to New York this past week for the launch of the Doxa Sub 300T Clive Cussler Edition. And obviously for that, I wore my Sub 300T Sea Rambler, and I've just kind of enjoyed having it on. It's a little bit of like a summer vibe, and I've got it on a mesh. I put a photo up on the Slack of it while I was in Midtown waiting for for that whole event to start. But I went down for, it was 24 hours. I went down there, saw some good buddies. You know, we saw Bilal, we saw James Lambden, we saw all the Doxa folks and all of their representation. Got a chance to see the watch, so we'll also get into the watches when we hit to the main topic. But yeah, I'm wearing the Doxa Sub 300 Sea Rambler. It's the 50th anniversary from 2017. I don't wear it as much as I probably should. Again, it's probably just the cost of having something new like the Pelagos that I've been enjoying.
Mm-hmm.
But man, it's a great watch.
Yeah.
Aside from maybe the loom, workers in the hands, the actual estate for the loom isn't great, so they mm-hmm. don't glow that well.
Yeah.
But otherwise,
yeah.
It's a great watch. Wears really nicely. It's fun on the mesh. It feels kind of specific, but a little bit different than wearing it on a NATO or even like a Tropic, which is, I was going to throw it on that vintage Tropic you gave me a few years back,
mm-hmm.
which is really fun for that watch. But
yeah.
I went with the mesh and I think it played out nicely and it was a fun event. I'll give people a breakdown when we get to the watch, but in similar fashion, what have you got on?
Yeah, I've also got a Doxa on. This is the vintage T-Graph, the Shark Hunter. I also haven't worn it in ages. Not quite sure why, but you know, given last week's event and was kind of inspired to pull it out and wear it, and I had it on the past couple of days. I'm wearing it fittingly on the original old Expandro beads of rice bracelet that it came on.
Oh, nice.
It's never been my favorite bracelet, but when I do wear it on this watch, it just feels somehow perfect in a way that I feel like the modern Doxa beads of rice just doesn't quite hit the mark. There's like a little bit of a miss to it, but this one's got this taper and it's really soft and kind of rattly and just wears really well. And even though it's a big chunk of a watch, it supports it well if you can kind of ratchet it in just right. So yeah, that's what I've got on. It's kind of a Doxa day for us, I guess. And I'm dying to hear your impressions of this Clive Cussler piece. I've got some opinions about it, and certainly a lot of people have have chimed in about it on Slack and elsewhere. So
jump right in. We can kick off the main topic, which is kind of a look at a bunch of new watches, some of which are very new, like in the last couple weeks, and some of which are just ones that we noticed that we kind of slept on over the last couple months since Watches and Wonders. So the first one would be this Doxa 300T Clive Cussler edition. It's not a limited edition. It's based on a 300T, so the specs are pretty solid and well-known from that standpoint. But it is kind of, it comes in a special box. It's all around kind of a special presentation. And then they've gone like an extra step with a several kind of tweaks and kind of aesthetic modifications to the watch. So the main one and the one that really sat the best with me is the case and the bracelet have this aged steel look, mm-hmm. which is actually a PVD treatment that's then stonewashed off of the watch or partially off of the watch and bracelet.
Okay, sure.
In person, I mean, I thought it looked okay in the photos.
Yeah.
In person, I really like it. Like, I maybe they'll find an excuse to, like, they said it took them 2 years to figure out how to get the case and the bracelet to essentially come out the same color.
Mm.
Like, they've been working on this for some time, and the bracelet would age or faux age more quickly than the case, I believe, or maybe it was the other way around.
Huh.
In person, I really like it. It looks like a really beat up watch with a little bit, the color is more gunmetal than steel.
Yeah.
And it has that sort of, I know there's a term for it that I'm blanking on, but where the edges, where the wear points are a bit brighter.
Oh, yeah.
So it has these sort of accent lines, kind of like you see with gunmetal or other sort of kind of broken down, older, antique metal that has a paint on it.
Is this what they call in the Leica world? Isn't this what they call brassing? Is that what it's called? Or am I thinking of something different?
Brassing is more of like a rubbing
that
comes off where the black paint slowly kind of is removed by scratches or rubbing. So, I mean, in a way, sure. It's a similar concept. It's just this isn't done with paint.
I see, yeah.
And then it's the same effect on the bezel. All of the accents for the watch are red, which I think work really well with the sort of deep gray of the aged steel effect.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond that, you have a dial that's sort of like aged parchment paper. It's like a yellow. It's really similar to the color of like yellowy loom,
mm-hmm.
but it's the whole dial. And then on top of the dial or kind of on top of that effect, there's like a compass rose that kind of splits the dial into four. And the compass rose has its own somewhat more like shiny application. So in some light, it's not there at all.
Yeah.
And then you turn it and it's quite bright.
Yeah.
And then the watch itself is signed in red, Clive Cussler, and the three coordinates of his birth date are also represented as red numerals in the date wheel.
That's clever. Yeah.
And it's cool. It's a nice effect. And the red, again, the like only using the red as accents is kind of nice. So Clive Cussler's in red, as is the date wheel nod to his birth date. And then the markings on the bezel, that sort of thing, as far as the paint. And then the case back is maybe my favorite part. It's this really complicated, really, you look at it and you think like, oh, that must have been lasered because it's so fine.
Yeah.
And then you touch it and it has like a full grain to it. So it doesn't feel like a laser, or if it's done with a laser, it's done much deeper than like the engraving on the back of my Pelagos, which you can barely feel with your fingertip.
Yeah.
But it's an engraving of all of the shipwrecks and a series of artifacts, I think including at least one plane that have been discovered by NUMA since it was founded by Clive Cussler. And it just kind of looks complicated and like something from an antique or some sort of fact of sorts. Obviously, when you take a closer look at it, you realize it's English and it's the name of boats and that sort of thing. But from if you zoom out a bit, it has a nice polished medallion for NUMA in the center, and then it's just surrounded by all the things that the outfit has done.
Yeah.
It's a really cool case back. I really found it fascinating. I like that they took all the text that's normally on the case back and they actually put it on the, what would you call this? The trunk of the bezel.
Oh yeah.
So like a Doxa has like a coin edge bezel that's actually thin, but it's raised up off the case a little bit by...
Yeah, sure.
Kind of like a trunk, I guess. I'm not sure of the exact term they would use. It's a collar of sorts. But now all... So the water resistance, the, you know, in tribute to Clive Cussler, et cetera, is all engraved along that. So the watch really feels kind of like, from an engraving standpoint and a finish standpoint, like really complicated.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they did a really, really nice job. Like I said in my story, I don't think this is going to be anybody's first Doxa unless you're coming at it as a hardcore Clive Cussler fan.
Yeah.
At which point if you've got another collection of cool Clustler stuff, this would look great with it.
Yeah.
But I also think if you have six other doxes or 10 other or 20, like doxa people are it's a great cult, but it's very culty. And I think if you had a bunch of these and you had this one in the collection, it doesn't look out of place. It still looks very much like a doxa. I think if it had been up to me, I would have made the dial a little bit more simple.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it necessarily needed the compass rose. I mean, that's a pretty small complaint. I don't think it's like the wrong move to have done more or make it kind of more specific or more tied to this background. And when I talked to Dirk Kussler, Clive's son, was there, he was thrilled by it.
Yeah.
He definitely felt like they had finally settled on something that his dad would have loved and that kind of represents not just the books and the doxa connection to Kussler, but also to Numa. And I think within that zone, within something that's for like a specific buyer, could be a Kussler nerd, could be a doxa collector, really probably not for a wider, like a significantly wider audience than that. I think it works really well.
I agree. I think I quite like all of the elements of this watch. I like the case treatment a lot. I mean, I'm like scheming on like, how could I turn something, a watch of mine, you know, experiment with something I have to make it look like this, like, you know, tumble it somewhere or whatever. I mean, they really did a cool job with that. It's how I want doxas to look anyway. And my T-Graph arguably kind of is starting to get there just from its age. But the dial doesn't offend me. I don't mind the compass rose and I like the color they chose.
Yeah.
I love the case back like you, but mm-hmm. You kind of have to separate out kind of the Kussler side of it. And then there's the watch. So as a watch, I like all the elements. I'm not sure it entirely comes together perfectly. I would love to see this case treatment done on a different doxa with a different dial, maybe a gray dial, or maybe it's you know, just something slightly different, something more conventional.
I was joking with them that they should take, you know, Shark Hunter or Pro dials and just leave them in the sun in Switzerland for a couple years.
Yeah.
And see what happens.
Yeah, or underwater.
And then put those in aged cases, right?
Yeah, right.
Like imagine just like a super faded Shark Hunter or like a barely orange Pro.
Yeah, yeah.
With that dark coloring, it'd be cool.
Yeah, and I love the case back. I like on this one, I think the bracelet looks good, kind of aged. The NATO they chose is nice. The box looks good. I have to admit, this would not be the doxa for me simply because, and this might be sacrilege to say as a diver and as a aspirational novelist, I'm just not a massive Clive Kussler fan.
Okay.
You know, I've read a couple of his books and left wanting a bit, you know, just with some of the elements of the story. That said, I think that what he did for kind of the thriller genre and the kind of being one of the outliers in that field with really good underwater kind of thriller content mm-hmm. is something to celebrate. So, you know, and cool that doxa paid tribute in this way. So,
Yeah.
I think it's a neat watch and definitely a conversation piece as we all have realized.
Totally. And it's like meant to be for a collector, like for someone who's kind of pre-qualified into the world. And look, for me, even you want to talk about picky, the fact that it's not a 300, like it needs, mm-hmm. for a Kussler, it has to be a T. He had a T, Pitt wore a T. Yeah. I get it. But for me, I only like 300s. The T's a little bit too thick. I never need the HEV. I just prefer the thin case of the, you know, the 67, which is, you know, that's why I have and have owned a couple of those examples. And then as far as the Kussler thing, I'm with you. I actually have never read one of his stories. You know, I'm a very late entrant to fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And I think yours and a couple of Bond novels are the only thrillers I've ever read, like fictional thrillers.
Yeah.
And I have is the Titanic.
Mm-hmm.
On my Kindle, which I intend to read this summer, so I'm going to give it a swing. That's the one that Lambden suggested I check out as kind of the first check in into the Kussler world. But yeah, a cool watch. I'm just thrilled to see doxa be doing anything.
Yeah,
and when you have a brand that's so closely tied to that core, the 300T and the 300 is kind of what I would see as their absolute core.
Mm-hmm.
It's got to be difficult to think of anything that adds to that or modifies that in any way. And I think with a difficult task, they made a cool watch.
Yeah.
That's the way I would see it.
Yeah.
Beyond that, what else have we got as far as new ones? Did you get a chance? I wrote up the new eras.
Yes. Yeah.
Their colorways, they popped up in the Slack. So I think the blue diver I like even better than the black one, the first mm-hmm. edition. And then they do this, I think it's called like moon or lunar gray for the pilot's watch.
Yeah.
I think both successful kind of iterations. When I saw that a press release came out, I thought, oh, you know, we're going to get a 39 millimeter version. Because a D1 in 39, I would be pretty tempted by. That's a very cool watch. I really like the aesthetic, the curved dial. But this is more of a new colorway. I really like the blue. They've done a nice job with it. What did you think of these?
They're so clean. I mean, I have a hard time even telling what's a photo and what's a render. You know, they really have such a minimalist, very stark, you know, white on blue, white on gray. It's clean lines. I'd love to see one of these in person. I have yet to handle one, but they're super sharp and looks like, did they tweak the movement in this too? Is it
So now it's a higher grade movement, and it's regulated to some level from them. I think it wasn't quite like a Cosc statement of, you know, like a very tight. But they said it was better than what was in there previously. But it's a Sellita movement,
yeah,
I believe.
Yeah, this is one of these brands that impresses me because it feels like they came on the scene. You know, they emerged like fully formed. You know, like they're less kind of early stage sort of awkwardness that you get with some brands where you look back after they've made a few watches and you say, oh, you know, their early ones were kind of rough. There's a polish to them that feels like, you know, that they've thought everything through from the beginning and kind of launched with their best. You know, everything from the straps and the fitment of the straps and you know, the typeface and the sweep hand and things like that. It feels like a really nicely thought out. You know, I can't speak to the actual build quality, but you know, I'm sure that's great.
No, they're nicely made.
Yeah, yeah,
for sure. They make sense for the price point. I don't think anybody'd be surprised.
Yeah.
What else we got here on the list? The Zodiac Seachron.
Oh yeah, yeah. Let's talk about the Zodiac Seachron. This is a watch that I think, you know, a lot of people were anticipating, and one that is such a kind of a slightly forgotten icon in Zodiac's history. You know, everybody kind of knows the Seawolf and the modern iteration, the Super Seawolf. But you know, they made some pretty amazing chronographs back in the day. You know, both dive chronographs and other. And I think they've done a pretty faithful resurrection of the Seachron here. It's definitely a bigger watch. And you know, from the photos I've seen, I mean, it looks to wear fairly big. It's a 42 millimeter case. I'm not sure of the lug to lug or the thickness of it, but it's a chunker. But you know, hey, it's a dive chronograph. As I've said in the past, like, you know, this T-Graph I'm wearing is a big watch too. And you know, the Aquastar, the Deep Star, and there's it's kind of tough to get away with a dive chronograph with some water resistance these days and keep it super slim. And I'm quite okay with that. And I think this would be even better on the strap. You know, I've seen a couple of pictures on a strap. Most of the ones I've seen have been on the bracelet. But I think all in all, it's a really handsome watch. They've got two iterations of it. They've got the kind of reverse panda with the white subdials on black, and then they've got this blue dial with darker subdials. So yeah, hats off to them. Again, another one I'd like to see in person. I think I'm such a sucker for dive chronographs, and this one's such a classic look.
Yeah, it's a great look. I really like the bezel treatment quite a bit. Pretty distinctive. I like the, you know, the price point at $24.95 with a Swiss automatic. That seems like it's in the market, the normal sort of market standing for something like this. You're still getting 200 meters of water resistance. Like you said, it's kind of this like nice mid-century, late mid-century design, kind of well iterated. Yeah, at 42 millimeters, it's probably a hair on the larger side of what people are preferring these days. But a good-looking watch, certainly. And you know, we remain kind of like impressed by what Zodiac's managed to do over the last couple years. And of course, we've got our buddy Mike there now supporting the brand. And I think these look great. Between the black and blue and the sort of reverse panda, I think I'd probably lean towards the panda.
Mm, yeah.
But then you see a video of the black blue and it's actually pretty nice. I like it.
Yeah, I'm a little split.
Handsome looking watches.
Yeah, definitely. It has a bit of that. Do you remember years ago when Breitling came out with the Super Ocean Heritage chronograph? It's sort of... To me, it hits the same, like it's a very classic looking, you know, pump pusher chronograph with big prominent pushers and then a great looking bezel. And I've always liked that combination as opposed to something that has a little bit more shrouded or something push pieces. I think I just like that this one kind of screams that it's a chronograph. It's a cool watch.
Absolutely, yeah. I think these are cool. Definitely something that's worth checking out. I should probably bother Mike for a hands-on at some point. Now that we've kind of missed the initial launch of the watch, but a handsome thing certainly, and I hope that the brand continues to kind of iterate upon the Seawolf and the Seachron and stuff like that.
Yeah,
so,
yeah,
it's good stuff.
Yeah, and then just a quick mention. Maybe we jump to these Citizen watches, the NJ015, the Tsuyosa. And I think, you know, if you kind of squint and look at them, these are colorful dial, integrated, steel bracelet sports watches, as we've been discussing a lot of lately. To me, if you squint, they almost look like the PRX from Tissot or, you know, a few others. But
yeah,
I think with
Rolex OP with a different case.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I guess of the ones that I'm seeing, I kind of am drawn to that kind of, I wouldn't call it a mustard. It's kind of a really deep yellow, kind of orangey mm-hmm. yellow hue. I think is pretty sharp. And you know, for $450, I think they hit the price right. So if you want kind of want this look, and maybe you're not, you know, full on ready to commit to, you know, a life of single watch wear in this genre, I think this is a kind of a cool alternative.
Yeah, 40 millimeters steel, bunch of different colors, 50 meters water resistant. It's an automatic from Citizen. I think the light blue is quite handsome. I do think the dial design is like intentionally pretty Rolex-y, pretty OP
mm-hmm.
In its execution. But then, of course, you have this integrated case. And it's not the sort of, you know, you've got a little crown at four, and there's some distinctive elements here that feel a little bit different than a simple like,
yeah,
you know, let's go after the OP. I mean, you also can't, but they don't do the OPs right now. So in those sorts of colors. But yeah, I really like that sort of Bahama yellow. The green's pretty handsome. I can't imagine you could go wrong with the black one or the, like, they're just a bunch of nice colors.
Yeah.
And Citizen does a good job. And I mean, this is arguably considerably more conventional, even kind of trendy than something like the Aqualand, but it gives you an idea like the breadth of what Citizen puts out there. And I think making the decision to go with an automatic kind of speaks to who they think would be interested in such a watch.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's a plus point for this watch. I'm glad actually it doesn't say Eco Drive on the dial for some reason. It just it kind of elevates it a little bit.
Yeah, I think it's handsome. It would be another one that I think you look at the renders and you kind of get one feel. It kind of feels like there's a lot of dial
mm-hmm.
for the case, and then but then you look at some of the wrist shots that they provided in the press pack. You can see the photos on Hodinkee, of course, and they look a little bit more balanced in real life. So I think as an alternative to a PRX, if you wanted something, maybe a little bit more, what's the fairest way to say it? Something that's a little bit more Rolex than it is AP.
Yeah.
In its like wider scope vibe, I think this could be a nice option. And yeah, I agree that the yellow kind of speaks to me at the most point, especially probably be the most fun as well.
Yeah. What about our friends over at Bremont? They came out with these two releases, a week or two ago. And boy, you know, one of them is a much more conventional, kind of a tweak on an existing watch. And then then you've got this Viper, which is just a wild.
Yeah, let's start with the MB Viper.
Yeah.
I'm not even sure how to contextualize this. It doesn't really like speak to me as like a watch that you would necessarily wear as much as it is kind of like a tech showcase for the brand.
Mm-hmm. Aesthetically, I think it's a bit of a miss, but I get why they did this. I mean, we talked about the Kussler Doxa and how it's for a specific kind of customer, maybe an existing customer. I think this is another case of that where, you know, you're not going to be, this isn't probably going to be your first Bremont. You know, it feels like a collector piece. You know, it's limited to 300 pieces.
Yeah.
It's quite expensive. I think in US it's like $6,800 or something, but, I like the story behind it. I don't care for the watch itself, and I cannot see myself wearing it, but you know, this came out of, you know, they say it came out of kind of a test bed timepiece that they when they were testing the new ENG movements, the kind of their in-house movements with Martin Baker to kind of survive all of those ejection seat tests, they needed kind of a test bed that you could anchor onto a bracket or something that you could strap onto an ejection seat for all the tests. And so now they've taken that and turned it into a wristwatch. And I think with that backstory, the watch makes sense. It was designed to be probably, you know, seen through high-speed video or however they were doing the tests, whether they, you know, through the salt fog or the acceleration tests and things like that. Yeah, I mean, aesthetically, that kind of orangey anodized aluminum on the black and the kind of the really chunky shape, and then the handset just doesn't quite do it for me. But again, I don't think this was an aesthetic exercise as much as it was, hey, you know, here's an opportunity to spin out something that came out of one of our test pieces, and I think collectors would dig it. So
yeah, I think much in the same way that the Kussler 300T isn't going to challenge, you know, my Sea Rambler or my want for a White Pearl. I like that this exists. It's kind of a cool thing in general. It has this nice story attached to it.
Yeah.
But as like a day-to-day wearing watch, even at only half a millimeter larger than a standard MB2, mm-hmm. I'd probably still lean towards the MB2 if I was in that zone.
Yeah.
But theoretically, we'll look back on this watch and see them make the leap from ETA-based calibers in the MBs, which of course had to go through all the proving process. Now they've done the proving process at some level for the ENG series. And then theoretically, we'll see those movements transition into a more conventional MB design in the future.
Yeah.
And I think within that lineage, it kind of makes sense. It's kind of a weird, quirky, sort of fun thing. And I mean, 300 is a very small number.
Mm-hmm.
Aesthetically, yeah, not my cup of tea necessarily, but I do agree that the backstory is kind of fun. As for the other of the two new ones, this is the Bremont Vulcan, so also limited. This one only 250 pieces, inspired by the Avro Vulcan. I'll include a Wikipedia page or something about the Avro Vulcan in the show notes. It has a really cool backstory. It's also like an incredible looking plane.
Yeah.
Really, really cool. And then as far as taking one of the HMAF series watches, the Monopusher Chronograph, I think this is a very handsome watch. I think it's a good looking thing. I almost wish they had gone like even further in making it, you know, like the Vulcan in some way. But mm-hmm. it's got a new handset and a new dial treatment. I think these are just a good looking thing that will probably sell quite quickly. And if you're already in the world of, you know, looking for or wanting a Bremont chronograph, I mean, maybe you threaded the needle and the timing worked out. What do you think of the design here? I think it's kind of fun.
I think it's very handsome. I mean, I had an Arrow for a couple of years and enjoyed it. And I like this kind of general aesthetic that you get from the 60s, 70s RAF chronographs, you know, the CWCs, the Lamanias and things. And I think those were the watches that Vulcan pilots were wearing. At first, I thought, you know, it's a little too close to the Arrow. They should have stretched a little bit and done some different stuff, you know. But and again, going back to the Kussler watch, I mean, that's an example of, you know, taking some extra steps to really make it unique. In this case, it's much more subtle. But as I started to kind of look at the different elements, I've warmed to it even more. I love, for one thing, I'm looking at a photo of it on this sort of textile strap
that has that cool, subtle
camouflage treatment on it. And then the running seconds counter on the left side of the dial has that unique sort of camouflage pattern that the Vulcans were painted in. And then, of course, you've got the radiation symbol for the right subdial. And then just those hints of that kind of battleship gray or admiralty gray that you get on the sweep hand and on the 1952. I think all of those, they come together. I mean, this to me is core, mm-hmm. you know, Bremont, what they do well. They make a handsome watch as opposed to the Viper, which I think is not a watch anyone would call handsome necessarily. I think this one is just a really handsome piece. So yeah, I like it. I think it's
a really good evolution of the Arrow's, like the base of the Arrow.
Yeah.
I think the hands work really well. The longer I look at it, at first it was kind of jarring.
Mm-hmm.
The skeletonized treatment on a very traditional handset. That's like it feels like a very Bremont sort of move.
Yeah.
They're only making 250, so not exactly something to talk about as like a broad product.
Right.
And the Vulcan's such a cool plane in general. I think it's just kind of fun to see the tribute and to see it done and with one of their sort of military chronographs.
Yeah, good piece. What are we left with here? We've got two more to talk about on our list. This Mito, the Ocean Star Decompression World Timer, that kind of slipped by us in all the Watches and Wonders excitement. This is a neat watch.
Yeah, I caught like very brief wind of it because maybe we care. Maybe it's in the Hodinkee shop, something like that. I can't quite remember. And then just recently, it came up in the TGN Slack because Teddy put a video up about it, and he really liked it. And I was like, oh, maybe we'll take another peek at it.
Yeah.
And I'm inclined to agree with the fellow on the Slack, and I apologize. I've already lost the message, but there's a lot going on here.
A lot going on. Yeah.
I mean, like it's a seriously handsome watch.
Yeah.
But then I start to think about it like, wait, what am I supposed to do with all of this?
Right, right.
The World Time bezel's gorgeous. I'm a big fan of Mito. Obviously, I have the Ocean Star GMT, the Hodinkee LE, and love it. Very similar design language throughout.
Yeah.
But the decompression timer always kind of, held me back a little bit because of how busy it was. The colors are incredible.
Yeah.
The blues, which pinks, one do you like? The yellows, the greens. I'd probably lean towards the blue one. The warmth
really
kind of helps a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm not really sure. I mean, it's also one of those things probably helpful to see it in person. All of that said, it is busy. The rest of it, at $1,300 on the rubber strap, I think this is a lot of interesting for the money.
Yeah.
If that makes sense, right? Like, you're not going to have another watch that's kind of like this. The ability to have this also be a travel watch, I think, is quite appealing with the world time. Depending on how you use it, of course, it comes with two straps. I think you get to pick from two different colorways. It's very busy, but I think if that aligns with your aesthetic, there's a lot here to like. I feel like every time I put this on, I would also need like a little card from my wallet to remind me how to use the decompression timer effectively.
Because somebody's going to ask you about it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Also, the diver, the standard diver version, the non world timers were crazy popular. They were difficult to find. So I think this makes sense. You get a caliber 80, 200 meters of water resistance. It's 40.5 millimeters. They're saying 13.4. I assume that includes the sapphire crystal. And then, yeah, like I said, it's a CO7-661 caliber 80. So you get 80 hours of power reserve and a date and a GMT function to track against that bezel. So I think a pretty cool watch, maybe a little bit busy for me. And at $1,300, you're really not that far off from the OceanStar GMT, the LE from Hodinkee, which I would probably lean towards just in that it's a little bit closer to my aesthetic.
Yeah.
But I could also see this being the one that somebody would buy and go like, this is my vacation watch. I'm wearing like a fun pair of swim trunks and this. That's my vibe for the next week, and I can't fight that. So
yeah, yeah. And it's one of those kind of, I feel like a Navitimer feels like a really kind of aviation nerd watch. This feels like a real dive nerd watch. I mean, I think it kind of along the lines of a Doxa, where, you know, any casual observer is going to ask you about that decompression scale on the dial. And
for sure,
like you said, you better have your cheat sheet with you, or the Aquastar Deep Star with that funky decompression bezel.
Of course.
I look at that. I was wearing mine a couple of days ago, and I remember when that watch came out, and I was researching it and writing about it. I for a brief time I knew how to use it, but it's like with anything, I've it's just slipped away. And I think it would be the case with this too. I used to know how these decompression scales worked on the dial from I think a Volcane that I reviewed years ago, and it's slipped away. So I'd have to refresh my memory, but cool piece. And then speaking of Aquastar, that's the last one on our list here that actually launches today.
We buried the lead on this one. So yeah, the new Aquastar Model 60. And if everybody listening could just picture a skin diver, that's what you get.
Yeah, yeah.
It is like the classic form of a skin diver. It's 37 millimeters wide. It's 47 millimeters lug to lug. It's 11 millimeters thick. It's a three-hand with painted Super Luminova. You get 200 meters of water resistance, a dome sapphire crystal. It's a bidirectional rotating bezel with a ceramic bearing, 60-minute elapsed time scale. Pre-order price is $990, so right there at the end of the three-figure sort of range. And it uses, again, like we've seen in other Synchrons and that sort of thing, the LJP G100 automatic movement, which appears to be kind of Le Jouperet's sort of evolution or take on an ETA 2824, that sort of thing.
Yeah, these are cool. I mean, I think we've seen so many skin divers over the years, and I think what's been lost, I think, in a lot of that kind of discussions about those watches is, Aquastar, they were one of the early dive watch producers and was actually a sub-brand of Jean Richard back in the day. And so you used to get kind of the originals that would say Jean Richard on the top and then Aquastar on the bottom or whatever. And it is just the archetype of the skin diver, like you said, and 11 millimeter height. It's a fairly slim watch, 37 millimeters. I mean, this is like a little unobtrusive, very simple watch that I think when you stack up the higher grade movement and the ceramic bearings and the bezel, sapphire crystal, I think you're getting a good amount of watch for $990, even if it is a very simple looking piece. But to me, it's one of those classic sort of dive watches that hark back to the really early days of diving, kind of in a very basic way.
Yeah, and I think in many ways, like $900 to $1,000 now is like $500 to $600 6-7 years ago.
Yeah.
In terms of just the watch world and what things cost. not always, but in some scenarios, you're also buying a recreation watch or like a reissue watch, a tribute watch that carries the same brand on the dial, that you pay a premium for that anywhere. And on top of that, comes from a guy who's pretty good at this.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
My sub 300 50th anniversary was made by Rick Marai, and Rick has been on the show in the past. You can check the show notes for that. Fascinating dude who helped kind of relaunch Doxa into the web era. He was a decade ahead of a lot of micro brands in terms of online retail and figuring out kind of the zone that people wanted when you're talking about watches that won't be made in the thousands. Mm-hmm. But in the hundreds that are made, they're precious to the people who do buy them.
Yeah.
They're very specific enthusiast product. And I think that's partly what we're seeing here. On top of that, you're just seeing, in my mind, like if you love a field watch, the diver equivalent of a field watch is a skin diver.
Yeah.
But in this case, you're not lowering your water resistance to 50 meters or 100. You're still getting 200 meters of water resistance. You get a solid bezel. I think it's an absolutely gorgeous watch. I mean, most watches were really pretty then.
Yeah.
It's the right size, I think, to reference a skin diver. I have a Silvana of a similar age that's roughly the same size and dimensions. And they just wear well on any wrist, on a wide variety of straps. And I think at $1,000 with Aquastar on the dial, I think it makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, I think if it was coming from a quote unquote micro brand with a brand new name or a name that had only been around for a little while, you might expect it to be a little bit less than that. But between the Le Jupre movement, which, you know, they're very careful to say has been adjusted in four positions. And I think these are solid. I'm a huge skin diver fan in general because they are like the everyman's diver. They're not too big. You're not paying for features you don't need. And they're kind of just beautiful. Like, with you could change the straps around on these things and really change the vibe on your wrist.
Yeah.
And outside of anything except formal dress, I just think they work and they reference that kind of sweet spot of mid-century diver without looking like a Rolex or a Blancpain, which I think goes some way in the funness, because you probably have other watches that look like those ones.
Right. Yeah, another nice release from Rick.
If you want to see more, you want to see photos, the rest of it, swing by Hodinkee. I'll have my introducing with live picks, et cetera, that would have gone up roughly within minutes of when this episode went live, or at least when the email for this episode went out. So swing by if you have more there. And otherwise, if any questions, that sort of thing, let us know on the Slack or in the comments on Substack about this watch or any of the ones we've just chatted about. That's a handful of pretty good watches that largely are all dated after Watches and Wonders.
Yeah, I would say. I mean, any one of these, I'd be well, maybe with the exception of the Viper, I think I'd be happy to wear at least for a little while and check out. Actually, I'd love to check out all of them, but yeah, some cool stuff.
Look, how about we jump into some final notes?
Yeah, sure. Mine is less, I guess, you know, something to watch or interesting read. It's more just kind of almost a news item that I just didn't want to let slip by. And that is there was an article on Outside Magazine about the woman who won the Golden Globe sailing race. And, you know, this is one of those arcane pursuits, those, you know, really intense activities that slips below a lot of people's radars. And that is the Golden Globe race, which originated back in 68-69 when Robin Knox Johnston won the first edition. And they've only run, I think this is only the third one, maybe the fourth one. I guess it's only the third running of this race. And what they've done with the kind of the modern equivalent of that race that was in 1969 is, of course, it's a solo round the world sailing race. But in its modern form, they are attempting to, as closely as possible, recreate the original race from 68-69 when there wasn't GPS, there wasn't, you know, satellites and social media and et cetera. So the sailors are restricted to the types of technology they can have on the boat. So they're shooting with film cameras. If they're taking pictures, they do have an emergency beacon or GPS or sat phone just in case,
capsize or get
into a life raft or something. But other than that, they're not, you know, uploading Instagram photos from every stage of their voyage and things like that. And so it's a really full on commitment for these sailors. And as with the first race, the majority of people who enter it don't finish. And there isn't a huge monetary award for this either. And to cut the long story short with regard to the winner of this one, it was won by a woman, the first woman to win it. And her name is Kirsten Neuschafer, and she's from South Africa. And I linked to an article in Outside Magazine about her, and she's a really unique person. really kind of, as the article says, you know, well equipped for the months of isolation and kind of hard work. She's a very no nonsense, you know, athlete, very skilled captain. And, just, it's an amazing story. I think, you know, if you've read the book, A Voyage for Mad Men, about that first race, or seen, some of the movies like The Mercy or Deep Water, about that race, you can't leave but be impressed and kind of terrified by this exploit. And you know, hats off to Kirsten Neuschafer for winning this one, and you know, who knows what'll come out of this, and you know, when they'll run this again. But it's a fascinating story. Wow. So check that out.
30,000 miles.
Yeah.
In 235 days.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they're basically not allowed to stop.
Right.
There's no like finding a port and restocking or the rest of it. No. It's essentially a sprint that takes three quarters of a year.
You fix everything on the fly. I'm total self-sufficiency. And
goodness sakes.
And to complicate things, she actually had to divert her course because an SOS call went out from another entrant in the race whose boat had broken up and was capsizing and needed rescuing. And she had to sail an additional, I don't remember how far, 100 miles or more, to effect a rescue on this person, for which she was able to pass him on to, you know, a passing freighter or a ship to take him to safety. But then the race organizers awarded her some extra time or something like that because she went out of her way to rescue this person. So, you know, not only is she, you know, sailing single-handedly around the world, but she had to rescue a fellow competitor as well. So, yeah, it's an amazing story.
Boy, I hope they gave her a pizza or something from that boat.
Seriously, man. Yeah.
That's crazy. What a challenge.
Yeah.
Super impressive. Yeah. Definitely a story worth reading. Man, that's so cool. My pick for the week is really nowhere near as interesting. The truth is, definitely not as harrowing. It's the last time that I spoke about a hat that I liked, I have a big weird head, and most hats don't work that well for me. In the past, I've spoken about the Pedro and Taylor corduroy hat, the washed corduroy hat, and I like those quite a bit, but I may have come across one I like even more. Huh. And it's summer, you want to keep the sun off your face. I've now lost two of my three Pedro and Taylor hats. I just leave them places. But my brother recently gave me a hat for a golf company, a golf bag company called Mackenzie. Huh. That's M-A-C-K, Mackenzie. But this hat, which is kind of a washed darker blue with a simple logo on the front, is made by a company called American Needle. And Jason and I have been kind of looking around at hats. We've been considering the idea of doing like a TGN hat, like a crew hat or something like that. I do like wearing a hat, especially in the summer. It seems like obvious reasons. And I just wanted to suggest this one out there. More specifically, this American Needle does hundreds of versions of their hats, some with logos, some without. You can probably find something you like. They do classic Americana, they do sports, they do beers, they do all sorts of stuff. This specific style is called the Washed Slouch, which I won't take personally, although that's fairly accurate. And it seems to be, you can get it like without a logo on it, which is probably my general preference. I don't know Mackenzie from something else, but for $23. And for $23, that seems pretty good. If you're curious and not quite sure you want to jump in, we're going to attempt maybe to do a TGN version in the future. So that's brand new stuff from this morning. So a little teaser there. I would say compared to the Pedro and Taylor, it's a little deeper, so it sits a bit lower on my head, which I like. Mm-hmm. And it's the materials, you know, that corduroy of the P&T, one of the benefits is it's quite light.
Yeah.
This is a little bit of a heavier material, but doesn't feel like those wool ones, the kind of throwback to the 30s, 40s style ones that you also see.
Yeah.
In short, it's nice. The brim comes curved or bent or however you would call it.
Yeah.
And I've been super happy with it. So the last time I talked about a hat, people messaged a lot. It comes up on Slack every now and then. What was the hat that was recommended for people with big weird heads like James's? My new favorite one is this American Needle. And for $23, I thought it was perfect for final notes.
Yeah. Yeah. Perfect. And
gotta have a hat for the summer.
Yes, definitely. And stand by for future TGN merchandise drops.
If we can make that happen, I think this is a product I would be pretty happy to have the logo on for sure.
Yeah. Cool. All right. Well, that was a fun show. I think good crop of new watches, some interesting final notes, and summer kickoff right this week.
Yeah, this is it. We're there, and we appreciate everybody, you know, allowing us an extra day to align with the Aquastar launch. If you want to dig into that or any of these other ones, be sure to hit the show notes. And as always, thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to subscribe to the show notes, get into the comments for each episode, or consider supporting the show directly, which could even nab you a new TGN signed NATO, please visit thegreynato.com. Music Throw to Siesta by Jazzar via the Free Music Archive.
And we leave you with this quote from the famed novelist Henry James, who said, "Summer afternoon, summer afternoon. To me, those have always been the two most beautiful words in the English language."